This Week in Tennis.
Hey, Craig, what's happened to the American men? I don't understand what's happened to them after the way they chirp all the time and the way they talk on the court. What happened to them, Craig?
I think they went home. Is that a fair estimation of what's happened in Indian Wells and again in Miami?
Well, we had a couple good results in Indian Wells. And this is This Week in Tennis. I'm Phil Nasons. He's Craig Doyle. We've been on this thing for about 16 years. We don't do it every week like we used to. It's more like an event for us, but we have a lot to talk about today. Big changes on the ATP Tour. I'm also going to answer a question a friend asked, and I've been meaning to for a long time, about why tennis is the most difficult sports. And then Aryna Sabalenka, she's tougher than nails. The U.S. men are in the toilet. And then, of course, we're going to broadcast my newsletter a bit, Craig. Let's start with the big changes on the ATP Tour. You called this over 2 years ago. You were the only one. I remember how many people told you were full of crap. Tell us all about these changes. Take your victory lap, my friend.
I don't think it's a case of a victory lap. I think it was looking at what else was happening in the world of sports. And we do like to look at the bigger world of sports. I know that you're engaged in March Madness at the minute, so you've got your finger on the pulse with our sports. But the increase in influence from the nation of Saudi Arabia on the world of sports has been exponential over the last few years. They've gotten involved in boxing. They've gotten involved in things like WWE's wrestling. They are bringing money to the PGA Golf Tour. Or in their case, they have an alternative tour that they have started. And they've taken an interest in tennis. And their interest has been rather passive at the moment. But as you can see, and all of our viewers, listeners rather, will be able to see, if you're viewing the Miami Open, the PIF logo now sits right on that screen alongside the main advertising sponsor for the tournament, because PIF, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, is the sponsor of the ATP rankings, something that happened at the start of this season. It's a pretty major deal. PIF have an interest in bringing the WTA Finals tournament to Saudi Arabia this year in a lucrative big money deal that seems to be attracting a lot of controversy from within the WTA. But they also have an interest in outright just buying tennis, whether it's the WTA and the ATP tours, or perhaps something bigger. Maybe it's not going to be that big. Maybe they just really want to get in on this Masters scene and have a big tournament over there to begin with. But they've got the money. The players are looking for bigger paydays. These people are starting to step in, and there's definitely going to be future involvement from the Saudi Public Investment Fund within the world of tennis one way or another. And I think we called it here on the show a couple of years ago, and a lot of people were turning around and saying, yeah, these guys have no idea what they're talking about. This doesn't happen in tennis. Yeah, well, there's money. People speak. People get interested. And I think, you know, we were right. The interest is there. It continues to be there, and it's going to grow.
Well, we'll see. You know what I don't want to see? What they did with the golf, because they divided the players in order to accomplish their LIV tour or live tour. I don't want to see that. The tour's already in enough trouble. You know, we've already seen what happens when someone kind of tries to start their own thing. So that's what my greatest concern would be, because right now that tour is in a precarious situation. And the way they talk, the top players, about how they want to spread the wealth and get the players ranked 1 to 200 any money, but these players aren't going to get any money, because when they expand these things to what they are calling a Premier League, that's one of their ideas, a lot of smaller tournaments where these challenger-level players go to get points won't be there anymore. So where do they get their points now? How do they get to play in these big events, Craig?
Well, that Premier League idea, interestingly, is not coming from the Saudi...
No, it's coming from Butch Buchholz, right?
Yeah, it's coming elsewhere. The Grand Slams seem to be the ones backing that idea.
Yeah, because it's Butch Buchholz and he's tennis royalty. That's why. He's the founder of Indian Wells.
We don't know, you know, where that sits. I think the ATP have pretty much discarded any interest in that or are trying to dissuade interest in it. But as you said, like, this is a pivotal time in the sport because you don't want to divide the sport up into different factions. It's already splintered and we already have enough factions between the ATP, the WTA, the ITF. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of potential for having, you know, the premier players playing on one tour and other people playing on another tour and just glorified exhibitions all over the place with just a handful of players. And it's not good. You've seen what's happened in the world of golf, which is it's denying the public the opportunity to see the best players competing against each other on a regular basis. But that's how these people move. You know, when you have that kind of money and you can put $100 million in front of someone, a guaranteed salary for a year, it's very difficult for that person to say no when going through a regular season on the ATP tour. They might make $5-6 million. You know, if you tell them they're going to make $100 million next season, most people are going to listen.
Yeah. Well, two things they are going to do, the ATP tour has done already, is expanded the tournament in Cincinnati and the one in the Toronto Masters in Montreal. Those would be 12-day events now. You know, I think the combined format works the best. It's probably what has kept the WTA tour even alive. You know, I don't listen to these gals about anything they talk about anymore. Craig, they pushed us so hard 40 years ago to push for Title IX, and we were willing. Title IX is the one that allowed girls to play in sports, form their own teams. You can't keep them away. If there's enough interest, you got to put together a team, stuff like that. This ain't going to be that way. This is going to be a mess. But what I don't ever want to see again, and we see this so often, explain this to me. How can you have Maria Sakkari, who's one of the best players in the world, playing on one of the hottest Americans in Emma Navarro, and there were more people in their respective boxes than in the stands? Now, I get it. It was late. It was windy. It was cold because the desert's cold. But why wouldn't you want to go watch in person one of the rising stars of the American side of the circuit? Didn't make sense to me. But that's been going on for years. These tournaments are like basically like funeral homes. They're not exciting, the WTA ones. They're actually kind of boring. The bagels. There's so many bagels now. I mean, why would you want to watch a match when you know one player is going to win 6-love, then the other player wins 6-love, and then they play for real like an exhibition? You can't have any of those things. So what do they do? What do they do to get people in the seats? Do you think the Saudis are going to get people in the seats?
Probably not. I mean, it takes time to change the perception of the sport, and it's very clear that the WTA tournaments in particular have a lot of problems filling seats on the early days of tournaments. It's very visible on the TV screen. If you get that court level view that shows the stands, sometimes you can count on one hand how many people are actually sitting there that are not affiliated with the players. It's really poor. I pointed it out, I think, the other day that it may have been Iga Swiatek had come out for a match, and I said, there's about 12 people watching this as she came out for the match. And I was like, I was astounded at just how few people were in the stands. And, the numbers do pick up later in the week when you get to the finals, but there's no doubt about it that even at the Grand Slams, when you have a women's semi-finals day, it's the hardest ticket to shift. We've commented on that at Wimbledon. They give the tickets away. At Roland Garros, you can go on a week before and buy a ticket to the women's semi-finals. They're really struggling for star power. These girls are not household names. You know, you go out on the street and you ask someone to name the top 5 WTA players, they'll probably get Coco Gauff. But do you think they're going to get Sabalenka, Swiatek, Rybakina, I'm not sure. I don't think the average person on the street knows who these people are anymore.
Well, no, that's another problem. The marketing is horrible. They don't really market them well. I don't think they hire marketers. But then tennis has never been very good at hiring people who can actually do the job. You know, just look at our broadcasting. My God. Those folks, especially the ESPN folks, and I know most of them. You know, I competed against some of them in juniors, but look, we need some fresh voices. You know, I'm so tired of listening to the same guys talk the same shit over and over. You know, three other changes. They're Dallas, Doha, and Munich were 250 events, and they'll move up to 500 events. So again, you got this issue where the acceptance list is a lot different at a 500 than it is at a 250. So if you're talking about getting more money in these kids' pockets, it's not happening. It won't happen that way, that's for sure. But the ATP has never cared about that. And I guess they don't have to. I honestly don't think they have to. But it should be interesting what they do. Somebody has to do something because it is awful. And I'll tell you another thing. When it comes to this marketing, now I can only talk about it in the United States, I guess. Is when I was a kid, almost once a week you could watch a tennis match on regular TV, national TV. We didn't have cable then. So they had televised matches usually on Saturday afternoon, Pat Summerall. It was great. You got to see your heroes on TV, and then you could push your grandpa to take you to a real match. In America, they don't show any tennis on national TV. They used to do the Grand Slams on Saturday and Sundays, but they don't do much of that anymore, and they show replays in the afternoon, you know, because their other programming is more important, and plus it pays the bills because people don't even watch tennis anymore, Craig.
No, tennis has a bit of a problem in that it's finding it very difficult to reinvent itself in a world where a number of other sports have found ways to reinvent themselves for the modern audience. I'm going to go and talk about a couple of sports here. They might not be big in your country, but they have become massive in the UK because they've modernized the sports and created variations of the sports to make them, you know, more accessible to a younger audience. One of those sports is cricket, which, you know, it's very similar to baseball in the States. But what they've done with cricket is they've taken a game that usually lasts about 5 days and then nobody wins at it and shortened it down to a 2-hour, 3-hour format that's very action oriented and brings in a younger crowd. They did a similar thing with darts, indoor Game of Thrones darts at a board. They shortened it down, made it really fast paced, made it exciting, added music, added a light show. They turn out 10,000 crowds every week, people watching, you know, eight fat blokes throwing darts at a board. So you got to look at tennis and go, well, your average tennis match, even best of three sets, you're looking at could be 3 hours worth of play. A ticket to the tennis, you might see four matches. So you're talking, you could easily see 8 to 10 hours worth of play in a day. A lot of people just, they don't have the attention span for that. They don't have the time in their lives to go down and see that. They don't have the time in their lives to sit and watch that on the TV. So the question might be, does tennis need to maintain the format that it's got? Absolutely, yeah. The Grand Slams are the pinnacle of the sport. There's no reason to change what we have there. But on the other weeks of the year, do they need to look at making a much more accessible format of tennis that perhaps there's tournaments where they just play, I don't know, maybe three tie breaks or something, and there's a winner at the end of the three tie breaks. You look at it and you say, well, that's crazy, but people said that with cricket. People said that with darts. They said they changed it. You're going to lose interest in the sport entirely. You ruin the sport. But I don't know, you know, sometimes you got to go do something crazy. You got to try a different format and see if people buy into it. Tennis has been very traditional in what it's done. It's stuck to the best of three format throughout the whole season. It's a good format at particular events. I've really enjoyed Indian Wells. I've really enjoyed Miami. But it'd be interesting to see what the viewer figures are like compared to other sports, because I think engaging younger people, particularly that demographic, I'm not so sure that tennis is doing that. I think it's still a rich person sport. I think it's very much a rich person sport that draws in particular regions of the world. And at the minute, it's not drawn in the US. I don't think it draws particularly well in the UK either.
Nope, they don't. You know, tennis is hard for TV programming too because of the length of matches. But some of the things that you described has been going on for 30 years. It's called World Team Tennis. That does okay, but it's also an exhibition. When you start reducing the amount of time players play to three sets, to three tiebreakers, it's not really tennis anymore, is it? I mean, you've taken it away. So that's my greatest fear. All these things are going to destroy the sport. Of course, if they don't do anything, it already is. Pickleball's taken over. Pay attention to that. They went boom fast. You know why? Because anyone can play. They don't need to take lessons. They don't really need any special equipment. You know, they can get everything they need for $40, put up a little net in their driveway, and away they go. See, you can't do that with tennis. So tennis has its challenges already. I hope whatever they do carries the sport and makes it better. You know, because I'm all about the sport. I don't give a shit about these yappers and all these other jagoffs who want to try to help things. Fix it. Find a way. Use your brains. That's what I say. Now, Craig, for years and years, there's been this debate. The hardest thing to do in professional sports is to hit a baseball. And I think it is. It's pretty tough. I played fast pitch softball for 2 summers, Craig. Just because, you know, I grew up watching it. They asked me to play. They said they're even going to give me a few bucks. I didn't have any tennis for the summer, so I committed to playing on this travel team in Midland, Michigan for 2 years. That was a lot of fun. Hard as hell to hit that one. 46 feet away, they're throwing 100 mile an hour BBs. That's hard to hit. Now, do that 40 times to win 1 point. And do that on the run 40 times or more to win 1 point. And to do that for over 4 hours to win a match. And then you have to play again the next day. And if you lose that one doing the same things you did the day before, you get to go on a plane and you get to fly 6 or 8 hours to the next stop on the tour. So you've changed four time zones. And you might have to play that Monday. Or even that next day in some cases. That makes it pretty tough. When you're looking at 30,000 air miles a month in some cases, the cost to get into the sport, when I was coming up, Craig, it was roughly about 35 to 40,000. That was in the 70s. It's way more than that now. You add that, then you go to all these different countries and you have to, you know, get used to the time difference. You have to get used to, in some cases, the differences in English. You know, English is the international language of the ATP, WTA, and ITF tours, but not everybody speaks that either. So, or varying degrees. So you've got so many of these factors into just winning one match or even just getting there. It's tough. It's tough, but the main thing is the amount of time you have to spend running to hit. I would venture to guess that a Major League Baseball player, if you made them run 36 feet back and forth to hit balls from both sides of the plate, I would say they'd have a hard time doing that. That's why I think it's hardest. What do you think, Craig? Do you think tennis is the hardest sport? You used to film it. What do you know?
You
What did I
mentioned
leave out?
injury, how quickly you can get injured, repetitive motions, the wear down the joints,
Oh.
the challenges of playing on different surfaces that have a wear and tear on your legs, the upper body injuries,
Oh.
the time spent in the gym, because you got to train, right? You got to be fit to do this. You can't just turn up and play. There's so many complications involved in being on the pro tour. Just
Oh.
get into the pro tour, as you've said, is very, very expensive. So a lot of people out there will try to get to the pro tour and they'll never make it, either through ability or lack of financing, lack of sponsorship, just inability to get places to play. The fact that it's not a massively popular sport either, so in majority of countries, tennis will be like the fourth, fifth, sixth sport in terms of preference for a lot of people. So the infrastructure that's out there, the number of court facilities that are there, the price of those facilities, just trying to get yourself into position to ever get onto the tour is one of the major challenges. And then there's also the fact, and we didn't touch on this either, you are playing an individual sport, a one-on-one, in most cases, sport. There's no substitutions. You know, if you get injured, you can't substitute somebody else in. You got to do it
No.
all by yourself. There's
Well,
the mental toll on that. You know, it's not like baseball. Like if you don't hit the home run or whatever, it ain't really a disaster, is it? Because the next guy's going to come in, he might hit a home run and bail you out.
right.
That doesn't happen in tennis. You know, if you let's just look at, say, Francis Tiafoe at the minute. He ain't winning nothing right now.
Nothing.
He's struggling to win a match. What does he do? He can't have a week off and put somebody else in there to get him through to the next round. You know, he's got to
Right.
solve that on his own.
While
And
he's playing, without
while
a
he's
coach in
playing.
his ear, without videotape. You know, I was watching baseball the other day because, you know, that's coming up this week, Craig. You know, when these guys strike out, they go sit down and somebody hands them a tablet and they go and review all these things. And then they don't have to hit again for another nine batters. A tennis player, you got to figure that out on the move. You know, the other thing too is the balls are different every tournament. That has a wear and tear on your arm. But you brought up something that was a very good point. Injuries. You know, when a baseball player gets injured, he's going on the injured list or whatever. The team is going to rehabilitate them. They're going to do everything they can to bring him back in the same way he was before he got hurt. Tennis players, that doesn't work that way because you have bills to pay and sponsors. So if you get hurt on Friday and you lose and you have a tournament on Monday or Tuesday, you may play hurt. I know guys who played hurt for years because they couldn't afford not to. And I think with these new changes, you're going to see that too. But there's a lot into this, right? There's a lot into this. Baseball is a great sport. Basketball is a great sport too. But again, you know what? You miss four shots, your coach pulls you, you sit down, you go, oh, geez, man. And you get to think about it, right? Tennis player, he doesn't get to do any of those things. And then he gets to open up his social media like any other 20-year-old. And gets to see a million you sucks every day. So what are you going to do? Well, one person who used to get a lot of that, and I hope I answered that question. And if I didn't, he's a great guy, by the way. Craig, you would love this guy. His name is Josh. He helped me do the newsletter. And what I mean by this is he was the one who happened to respond first when I was looking to test it, because you didn't. Because you already knew the pain I was going to put you through. So anyway, he helped me out there, and if it wasn't clear enough, he knows how to get a hold of me, and I'll even go further with it. But you know, for years they talked about Arena Sabalenka, tin head, right? They used to call her mental midget. What a tragedy in Miami. How do you like that? First of all, this is what pisses me off about it. Is the media didn't even think for one second to find out, and these are people who are supposed to cover the tour, didn't even realize that she had broken up with her boyfriend weeks ago. That was the first thing. Did you see how tough she was to come out there and beat Badosa the way she did? That was pretty tough. She came out there in all black, like she was mourning. I loved it.
That's a different level of mentality. I mean, all the
That's a
things
different level of fuck you, right?
we just talked about a couple of minutes ago, in terms of how tough it is mentally just to be there in the first place without other things piling on. That was a different level of just mental strength to be able to come out there and play under those conditions.
Tough.
Oh yeah, and she's also Belarusian as well, which attracts, you know, negativity in
Oh
today's
yeah, see,
environment.
that's another thing. That's Fidelina
She
girl. She
she's gonna
runs the
carry that around her neck everywhere she goes.
Oh yeah. Thanks to one player who I tell you what, dear. If you lose to Naomi Osaka, you ain't as good as you thought you were. Let's just put it that way. But Sabalenka was tough. She lost the next match. That's understandable, right? But She came out. She, you know what? If she would have said to the tournament director, James Blake, I can't do this. Did they give her a pass? Normally you would get a fine for missing a tournament like that, but they wouldn't even fine her for that. That's an excused withdraw, if you ask me. It's not like some of these players who play exhibitions on Sunday and then withdraw on Wednesday, you know? Make $1 million in Vegas and then go back to Miami and say, you know what, I can't do this after all. Stuff like that. All right, so I buried the lead with the U.S. men. I have an article coming out today on Passing Shot Productions, passingshot.com, I think it is. You'll find it on my Twitter feed, wherever it is. U.S. men are in the toilet, Craig. They have been ridiculously bad for a long time, for a long time. You know, you hear them, but you don't see them on the podium. You know what I mean? What do you think about these guys? Honestly, let's be honest today with our listeners who bet on these yo-yos every day, or I should say these young guys every day. I don't mean to call them yo-yos. What do you say to those people?
I'm sorry, I got thrown by the use of the word yo-yo there.
Oh, yeah, because you know what? Because there's, yeah, you're laughing because you know what I want to say.
I do know what you wanted to say. I mean,
I wouldn't call them names, but I promise you, if that little shit turned around on me and said, you suck, we'd be dealing with that later. We'd be dealing with that later. His father would have dealt with that later the same way I would, and the way anybody in our age group came up would do that. Go ahead, though. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, no, it's very true. It's a different world now, though, isn't it? And it's sometimes when you come from the... I mean, I come from obviously a different generation that you come from, but the generation that I come from, I think the sort of reaction and consequences would have been quite similar to the generation upon which you've come from. Now it's entirely different, and people like you and people like myself, we find it a lot more difficult to get our heads around the lack of consequences for such behaviors and just the lack of understanding that's out there. And then when you do call one of these people out, they're looking for empathy from you, and they can't understand why you react in the way that you do. So it's messy, isn't it? It's messy.
It's messy. But Ben Shelton, I was talking about him yesterday on Twitter. Somebody was talking about his 143-mile-an-hour serve. He should have never went to college. Shit. At 17 years old, that kid never gets past the first year on the tour. One, he didn't have the money. Two, what you see now isn't what he was when he was 17. That's for sure. He needed those years. He needed the free equipment. He needed to get his bag right. He needed his financial bag right. He needed to get everything in place, and then he needed to make sure he had a coach. You know, the problem is his dad's been his coach his entire career, and his dad was coaching at University of Florida. So he had a job to pay the bills, you know, because it's expensive. A lot of folks that talk about tennis don't really understand the sport. They understand the what goes on when they play, but they have no clue what it takes to get to that point. And that's a different thing. But these guys, Shelton lost 17 consecutive events, or he didn't win a consecutive match in 17 consecutive events. So I'd say that 143-mile-an-hour serve ain't as big as you think it is. That's what I think. Don't fall in love with these serves. But back to that, these kids chirp a lot, Craig. But they don't just, it used to be reserved just for changeovers or if it really got dicey in a match, you know, where they'd be shouting at each other from the service lines. These kids are talking smack when they lose points. I've never seen anybody talk smack when they lose. Maybe in the movies. Do you think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that this generation watches too much NBA? I know Ben Shelton thinks he wanted to play in the NBA. The sleeve, he's got all the NBA stuff, the smack talk, the chirp, except he doesn't have the backup part yet. You know, the back it up part. Who's the best American, though?
Wow, that's a really difficult question.
I had to say that about Shelton. I love their family. You know, his mom, If you know anything about the Indy Open, the Indianapolis event, Shelton's uncles, that was where they were the head pros at that place. The Indianapolis Tennis Center, I think, is what it's called now. His mother is their sister. So these folks are tennis royalty, the Witzkin family. This kid has a big tennis background, but he didn't even bother playing full time until he was 17. And like his old man said, you ain't even good enough. You're not even the best player in the United States. What's going to happen when you leave? Because the United States, it used to be a hotbed for tennis. It's not anymore, at least for winners, champions. What's up,
No,
Craig? Where's
you're right.
you? I've been baffled. I've been
You
just
have. You've
bamboozling you
been
today.
just knocking holes in American tennis for the last 5 minutes while I've
I've been doing
sat
that for
here in
20
awe.
years. What are you kidding me? You
Well,
know when I
yeah.
learned American tennis was full of shit? When I moved overseas and watched it from the outside looking in. But anyway, go ahead, bro.
So you ask who the best American player is at the minute. I think is it still Taylor Fritz by ranking, but he's playing relatively poorly. Tommy Paul, he had a horrific injury the other day.
Oh.
Ben Shelton's up there, but so's Francis Tiafoe. He's been playing dreadful for the last few months. Sebastian Corda's never really gotten above top 30. He just sort of hovers around there. Christopher Eubanks has had about one good tournament in a year. It's there's you know there's not a lot of good stuff going on up there, but
You hear them a lot, though.
yeah,
You
well, I
hear
was
them
just
on
about to say, like,
podcasts, and they're in the commentary booth. Whoever heard of that while you're in season?
it's not just while you're in season, it's while you're in season and you are not a top player on the tour. You're not a top 10 player. You're not getting, I mean, how many of these guys have reached a final recently at a 500 or Taylor Fritz has, but at a Masters, let's say at a Masters or a Slam, how many of these guys are reaching regular finals at Masters and Slam events?
Well,
None of
that's where
them,
you find out, yeah.
you know. And that's where the difference is. When you look at the top 10 guys, these guys are reaching finals regularly at the top events. And I watched that 143 mile an hour serve the other day, by the way, and it went right down the middle of the court. And I thought, you know what? Had Carlos Alcaraz or Jannik Sinner been standing there,
And
that would have come back, by the way, with interest. They would have had the racket on that.
that's what's the problem. 'Cause see, here's the thing. You can have that big cannon, that bazooka, and that can get you to juniors. But when you go up against the best players in the world, and this kid really didn't play any satellites or futures, he played some ITF challengers. His family did it right, and we'll have to wait and see how long it takes. It usually takes 5 years to make a big move. He got in there because he got hot at the U.S. Open. And that helped him a lot. He got that wild card because he won the NCAAs, which is a big thing, by the way, also. But winning the NCAA tournament is not the same as winning a Grand Slam. I know that doesn't sound the same to you, but it really isn't the same. Or it sounds the same to you, but it's not. The talent level at the college level, I would say, is probably, if they played full time and kept ranking points, they would probably be around 120, 130, the top players. It's not Carlos Alcaraz. It's not Novak Djokovic. It's none of those guys. That's a big
Is
adjustment.
the difference for you the fact that the return game is just so much better on the tour? Like, I've seen some
Ugh.
guys come on with a great serve, like John Isner, who he was a great player in terms of serve, probably come through the college system doing quite well. I've seen guys like Cam Norrie come on who came through the college system,
Yep.
and a variety of others, and they all seem to be pretty competent on serve. But in terms of return game, when you look at the top players on the tour, it just seems to me that these guys return a lot better than any of these kids who are arriving from the college game onto the tour. And that level of return makes a huge difference, because when you boom down, and John Isner will tell you this, he had a career of it, he'd be booming down 140 mile an hour serves multiple times per set. And he would still lose a lot of service games to guys who just were able to pick him off. They were able to get behind that big serve and get it back, or they were just patient enough to wait until he had a bad service game and then just pick him off. And it just seems to me that, like, the college game is very serve dominated. If you've got a great serve, you're going to do really well at the college level. But if you've got a, when you come on the tour, if you've not got the return game, and let's be honest, there's some people who have a decent return game. They come on the tour and then they bump into someone like Novak Djokovic, where the return game's not just good, it's absolutely exceptional in terms of standard. He's going to get more balls back than anybody else. He's going to cause you problems that you've never faced before. So do you feel that that's maybe the missing link in the college game, and that these kids are not up against opponents who are actually able to return and cause them difficulties on serve that they're going to face when they do come on the tour?
Yeah, those are good points. You know something? One of the biggest problems, the difference between the college game and the pro game, is the size of the court. I'm not talking about the size of the playing surface. I'm talking about the number of feet it is from the baseline to the backdrop. It's usually 21 at a major. It can be anywhere from 8 to 10, 15. My last gig, they had some college events there, and these kids stand right on the baseline because they really don't have a choice. Where you see Daniil Medvedev has probably made this the most well known, his style is he's got his back seat, his back end right to the backdrop. And if he could sit in the first row, he would, because it gives him more time, you see, because he can get a full crack at the ball. That's the problem. And in college tennis, you can't. They don't play on clay very often, so it's mostly on hard courts. It's mostly on at clubs that aren't set up for this, like a pro tour event would be. Like, for example, you need so many feet from the baseline to the backdrop on the top three courts. You need this much room between the sideline and the camera row on the sideline on those three courts, or these two courts, to have an ATP 500, for example. They don't have those things. Are so much different in college.
And
But I
those
think.
things are driven by external factors as well, like insurance. You can't have the camera close up because of the insurance regulations. If you've got a tripod close to the court, there's a trip hazard, the insurer won't pay out or they won't cover your event. So yeah, it's a completely different environment. I get that. And you're not going to get that environment in court, sorry, in the college circuit, because the facilities are not built to those
No,
specifications. That costs
very
money to
rare.
have bigger facilities like that anyway.
Very rare do you see that in college, but it is what it is. It's going to become better though, because this NIL, this name, image, and likeness, that money that college kids are starting to get now and getting big money, you're going to see that tennis, going to college for 4 years or 2 or 3 years and getting your bag, financial bag set up, is going to be even more attractive than it was even before. So I think we're going to see a rise in that. I think we're going to see more kids going to college, more kids staying longer than they usually do. Like, for most of them don't graduate when they go. They stay 1, 2 years, go a long way in the NCAAs, pick up a sponsor and hit the tour and hope for the best. I don't think you're going to see that as much now. I think you're going to see guys stick around and get that money, because we're also seeing longevity on the tour. My day, you were done at 30, 31, 32 maximum. Again, the travel used to get you. That's the biggest thing, the travel. Now they're playing till they're 37, 38. So going to college for 4 years till you're 21, then embarking on the tour with some financial security, because you should have at least 5 years in the bank. At least, if you don't have $250,000 in the bank, don't go out there on the tennis tour. You won't make it. You'll go bust. You'll go bust. You need money out there. You got to pay coaches. You got to pay for everything. You got to pay for your wannabe Instagram girlfriend to travel with you. That shit's expensive, Craig.
Yeah, no, there's only so much financing you can get off other people, and that route's ruthless as well, because the minute they smell that you're not going to deliver in terms of dollars in the bank for them, they pull the plug. I watch it over here, because the route into tennis over here, we don't have the college route that you have. Either you make it as a youngster or you don't. And at 13, 14 years old, they're cutting kids' sponsorships because they're like, yeah, you're not going to make it. You're not going to get to deal with the racket company or the ball manufacturer or the shoe company. they're not interested in sponsoring you at 13, 14 years old because you didn't win certain tournaments. You know, your chance of making the tour then is done because you don't have the financial lifeline that they were providing. And once that's cut, it's almost impossible to get on the tour. You don't have them unless you've got a lot of money and that your parents can continue to provide all of the equipment and all of the coaching and all of the travel. You ain't going to get on the tour once they cut that lifeline from the sponsors. And they do that really, really quick. And we don't have the luxury of having a college system. Like a kid here, if they want to make it, like you look at someone over here, their best option is actually to apply to US college, get themselves in there, get an education, play on the college circuit, and get on the tour that way. That's probably the most financially sustainable way for a British player to make it onto the tour is to go through your college system, which is just, yeah, it's crazy, but it's probably the best route.
It's the best route. I love coaching in Europe. You remember those camps I used to run where we would send European kids to colleges in America. That's there, and I'll tell you something else. If you're a European junior tennis player listening to this, you have an edge over your American counterparts. Coaches don't want their American counterparts because they get a bunch of mouthy little country club kids with country club smirks and lazy and don't think they have to work hard. And I don't have to watch them. The European kids, they come over and they're all business. They say, I got this free education and they're giving me money and I get to live well and eat well and I get all my stuff for free. Bless me. But back to the U.S. players. You know, Sebi Korda, you mentioned him. He's got 100 match wins, but he hasn't beaten a single player. Not a better player than him.
Which is something that's quite easy to do on the tour, right? You can accumulate these match wins at lower level tournaments where nobody really turns up.
Win a match in the first or two rounds and do it over and over, get some health, and you can make 100 wins. But if you want to be Gael Monfils, he just won his 550th career match. Never won a major. 550 career matches on the ATP Tour. I said this in my column that you can read at passingshot.production. Can I tell you something? And the link will be in our show notes. I got to tell you, these people are goofy. They're not going to win. They're not going to win anything, these U.S. players. They can't beat themselves. They can't even beat their own image. I lost my train of thought, Craig, for some reason. Something happened outside. Anyway, my thing with the U.S. players is that they chirp too much. They do not win, ever win. But all you do is hear about them. And I'm tired of hearing, and I want to see some winning. But I did say in that article, and that's why I was looking for, where is it? Oh, it's not published yet. But the bottom line is these guys are not performing very well. How do you have an America tournaments in America where you can't even compete? How are you crashing out in second rounds and laughing about it? How are you fist pumping over net courts? How are you telling somebody they suck when they beat you? This is who your American tennis people are. Every single one of them are the same. They're chirpers. They can't win. That's why they lose. Look at the Miami tournament, Craig. There's three Americans left in the draw. You've got three kids, four kids in the top 20 in the world, and they can't even get past the third round in their own tournament. That's pretty bad, ain't it?
It is, and the bigger concern is, you know, if we went back 5 years on this show, we'd be talking about, well, let's go back 10 years on this show.
Same thing.
We'd be talking about similar things, but at least the American players would perform relatively strongly in these two tournaments, plus the tournaments in the lead up to the Open. You know, you'd get John Isner coming out, and he'd make a semifinals or a final of one of these events every now and then. You'd have other American players. They'd have decent performances in these events. They'd suck on the clay, but we know why, because they don't grow up playing on the clay.
Right.
But generally, these tournaments here on the hard courts in the US, you'd be looking at guys getting to the the fourth round of most of these events. Now you're not even getting by the second round. So
I know.
it's a massive regression in the space of 10 years.
So here's what you have left in Miami. You have Sebi Korda taking on Hubert Hurkacz in the round of 32. That's not going to be easy for him. Christopher Eubanks takes on Alexander Zverev in the round of 32. That won't be easy for him. And the other one I saw, let me see. Let me see. There's one more. There's only three left. Who's left? Eubanks, Sebi Korda. This thing is a ridiculous thing. This site is a disaster, by the way. It just doesn't work. That's it. That's it. That's all that's left. Isn't it? This site, this is another problem. These websites don't work. They don't function. Like this draw, it isn't even a draw. Look, I can't even get it to scroll, Craig.
Welcome to the complaints that I've had about the websites over the last few years.
This is a
I,
joke.
I've
You
always
can't
thought they're
even see who's
relatively poor.
playing.
I think I may be wrong, but I think Shelton's still playing.
Yeah, Shelton's still in there too. That's
He's
right.
playing
What kind of shit
against.
is this? You know, this is another problem. You make these things so difficult for anyone to find. You
I think
can't
he's
even
playing
find
against
a player.
Musetti.
What's that?
You think he may be playing against Musetti? I know that the winner of that one plays the winner of Monfils and Alcaraz, so it's a tough draw for whoever wins it. But I'm pretty sure he's playing up against the Italian Musetti.
Yeah, it's Musetti. You see, now it's working. Look, now it's working because I had to refresh the page to make it work, Craig. You know, kind of like American players. They need to refresh the page. They need to start over from square one. They need to get the celebrities out of the development who couldn't develop a Polaroid and get some actual tennis people in there who can. The problem is they'll never do that. Instead, they got their country club crew. These kids that you see today, you're going to see 20 years from now on TV commentating, replacing the dinosaurs that are on there now. But American tennis is in real trouble. However, I did note one thing in my article of something that was positive. You ready for it? You're going to be shocked when I tell you what this is.
Yeah, hit us with it.
Tristan Boyer, young American. He won a clay court challenger in Mexico Saturday.
Which is a big achievement for an American player.
Damn right it is. Good for him. Great job. He's ranked 225 in the world, so we may not see him for a while. But damn, you don't see too many Americans playing on clay courts, especially at the challenger level. They're looking to get points, right? That takes balls.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, I thought you were going to say you don't see too many Americans playing after the second round in tournaments.
Well, you don't, but he made it. He was an exception, but of course you couldn't watch the match. You couldn't even find highlights of it. That's how bad it is.
Well,
Okay.
somebody did come out. I think it may have been Mark Petchy, who came out recently and said that the problem, one of the big problems in the sport, is at the foundation level, and he referenced exactly what you referenced. These challenger and futures events, you can't see it. You turn up, it's a shambles. It's a joke. It's really, really poor. We'll go into that another time, because that's a
Yes.
whole show you and I can talk about this. But Mark Pesce pretty much made that comment that you just made on his Twitter feed last week.
Yeah, I don't follow him, so I guess, yeah, cool. Mark Petchy's an actual tennis person, though. See, unlike some who are on there, especially on Sky Sports, Eurosport. Ugh. Anyway, let's run through this round of 32 real quick for these folks. These are nice one or two listeners. Alcaraz Monfils, nothing to see there. Musetti Shelton, that could be a good one. What do you think about that? Shelton got a shot? Can he unhook the cannon enough times to win?
On a hard court, I think so, yeah.
Oh yeah, he should. Musetti's a good player though. We'll see. So Shelton, I don't know what the odds are there. Nothing seems to want to work today. $2,000 fucking computer, Craig, and I guess it's these websites. Dimitrov, Hanfman. Dimitrov is playing great ball right now. He's got, what, 14, 15 match wins?
Yeah, and he's playing against a journeyman there, Hanfman. I think, yeah, Dimitrov, he started the season really well. He's just not managed to, get those turn those wins. I think he's like 15-4 for the season or something. He's just not managed to turn those into a major success anywhere, which is a shame for him. But yeah, I think he
Yeah.
wins again.
I think so. Korda plays Hurkacz. I think Hurkacz sneaks in. What do you think? Does Korda have a chance to make this a match and go three sets?
I mean,
Play the over?
he's beaten him before in the Australian Open last year at a high level. But I think like off them, I like his chances because Hurkacz in terms of defensive play and return game is absolutely dreadful.
You
So of
think?
course, yeah, I think he's one of the worst players, one of the worst top players in terms of return. But he's got a great serve. If his serve is off, then I think Korda, if he plays relatively solidly, will win. I think there's an opportunity there. But if Hurkacz is serving well, then yeah, forget it.
Forget it. I think that you have to revisit his return game a little.
Oh, I
That's
will.
something. That's what I've noted that his biggest improvement to me is. You don't have time to watch this kid. I don't blame you. He's probably cost you money before, and you have bad memories of this. It brings back flashbacks, you know.
When I backed him in the Australian Open earlier in the year, and he didn't do
Oh,
very well.
Jesus. Yeah, you know what though? But I love that kid, you know. He's a tremendous kid. I'll tell you who I think a lot of too, and he's not in the draw anymore, is Francis Tiafoe. And here's why. Because, he's from Baltimore, the area, where they play the Legg Mason or the DC Open, whatever you want to call it now. That means he's the host. That means he's got to make sure everything runs good because, that tournament helped put him on the tour. Financially, they backed him, gave him free, the whole thing, right? He earned his stuff. But they also helped him a lot. So he is very grateful. That's what I love most about him, how kind he is. He got Hurkacz, Shelton, and Christopher Eubanks to play the first match of the day of the tournament at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in DC in the heat in August. That's the type of human he is. He got those boys to come out and play in a doubles match in a 250. You know what I mean? That's big. I wanted to put that in. I've been meaning to say that for a long time. Zverev takes on Eubanks. I think we're going to see Eubanks back in the booth by 2 hours after Zverev takes him out. What do you think?
Yeah, not much to see there.
I like his commentary though. He's slick, man. He's got the suit. He's got it all. He's not like the old guard of the ESPN crew who don't really care anymore because they're celebrities. Sarandolo takes on Kakhanov. Kakhanov is starting to come on. Remember how hot he was a couple seasons ago? He looks healthy, but Sarandolo can hit the freaking ball. So this could be interesting.
No, Kakhanov, he beat him here last year as well, actually. I think it was here last year. Maybe it was Indian Wells, but hard court, yeah, I'll go with the Russian on the hard court. I think he's really good.
I think he could. I do think Sarandolo can get a set from him, though. I think that goes over. I like what Sarandolo has done. He's not played well. Alex de Minaur, he's taken on Struff from Germany. What do you think? Alex has played really well. He's has a couple. He repeated in Rotterdam, I think. Was it Rotterdam here or was it Doha? One of the two. But he takes on Struff, a big hitter. But the wind has been blowing down there. They're also bitching about the humidity, the players. It's kind of funny. It's always the case, though. When you go from the desert to the swamp, that's what happens. Don't you understand that?
I think you've got to go Damon Eure here. Like Struff hasn't
Yeah.
started the season particularly well. I know that he's had success against Damon Eure in the past, but I think you're seeing a bit more from Damon Eure these days than what we did when he was sitting ranked around about 20 in the world. Now that he's up there in the top 10, he actually looks like he belongs there at the minute.
He does. You know something he does. You know who else is looking good is Popperin. He's taking on Muratsin. This is a big opportunity for Popperin because he ends up with the winner of Struff, de Minaur, and he could beat both of those guys. This kid's on the rise, man. What do you think of him?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually an interesting match because I don't know a lot about the Hungarian. I've only seen him play once.
Right.
he's another one who's played a lot of tournaments this year, but he's not posted a lot of results. But you look at his career record, he's 19-17, so he's not been around long enough to get a flavor for what he's all about. This is a big chance for either of these guys. Whoever wins this one, it's a huge chance to take a step forward. So this could be the match of the round.
You know what? You're right.
If you're getting a good price on Popperin, I think that's the play.
Well, that's just it. That's the other thing, getting a good price. So important. Casper Ruud, he's moved on to the quarters already. Or is it quarters already? A round of 16. Where are we at here?
Yeah, he's in the next round.
This thing just died on me again. This website, the Miami Open web. You know what, James? Fix your freaking website. My God, you want us to promote your tournament because obviously it needs it. And now you don't make it easy for us to do that. All this money, Craig, I can't make a site that works. I spent $50 on mine. Mine works perfect. Grigor Dimitrov taking on Hanfman. Grigor crushing. To see, I'm already way behind because it recharged or refreshed on me, this page.
So we're on Casper Ruud and Nicholas Jarry, who are playing in the round of 16 the next day. So Casper Ruud, he's been pretty hot at the start of this season. He's 16-4 year to date. I think he's playing some really good stuff. This is the best tennis I've seen him play in probably about a year, maybe longer than that. So I'm probably going to say that Casper Ruud's going to win that one.
I like Jerry a little bit because I like his serve. He's played well. He came back from the grave yesterday against Sable Wild. It's a big match. Okay, so, but I guess we're going to split our opinion on that. Maybe three sets. Hugo Humbert got upset by Dominic Kiefer. Kiefer's another scary one, and he's got Medvedev tomorrow. What do you think there? Kiefer probably doesn't win, but he might get a set.
He might do.
Left-handed serve?
Medvedev's so good, though, isn't he? He's your guy who's going to get to the final and he'll lose to, you know, one of the other two that's just better than him at the minute. But, yeah, I don't see somebody taking Medvedev out before the final unless he runs into Jannik Sinner, which I think it would need to be the semi-final where he'll play Sinner. Medvedev's just really solid.
Medvedev is really solid. He's a champ. I'll tell you something else. The Czech players, there's three of them under the age of 24. Thomas Mahak, he's one of them. He's taking on Matteo Arnaldi. You want to talk about Generation Next? That's it right here. This one tomorrow between Magic and Arnaldi is going to be freaking fire.
I think you could spin a coin on this one. I really do. I saw Machach beat Murray. It was, well, I think Murray ended up beating himself, to be honest. But
he got hurt, didn't he?
Yeah.
The shit out of me. When I saw that, I had a flashback.
Yeah, I said to you, and I was like, I think they need your expertise down on the court side because it looked like the same injury to me. But he got up, and thankfully he looked like he was okay. But these two guys are interesting. You know, year to date, 6-5 against 7-7. And then career win-loss records, Machach 22-22 and Arnaldi 27-26. So these guys are fresh on the tour. You know, this is going to, you know, it's lucky they're not playing at Wimbledon because these guys are greener than the grass on the court at Wimbledon.
But that's a good thing, though. See, because I'm so sick. You know the other thing about this Miami Open before we go on? I know I just sidetracked us probably. The best thing about this is that Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal, and Roger Federer, none of them are there and no one's even mentioned it. That's a good thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we got to move on, right? You know, these guys are at the end of their career. If Rafael Nadal ever does appear again, treat it as a special occasion.
He will at all the exhibitions where they pay him $1 million. He'll make sure he's there for that.
He's the ambassador for Saudi tennis these days anyway, so he's But
he's
Novak Djokovic.
Go ahead.
Take Djokovic. If he appears, treat that as a special occasion as well. Yeah. He'll turn out for the slams and stuff, but he's not going to turn out every week now. You got to look beyond these people, and you got to, you know, the story's on the tour again. Jannik Sinner's announced his arrival. Carlos Alcaraz, he's starting to play like he did the middle of last year. Daniel Medvedev's knocking on the door again. all of a sudden, you know, there's new stories to get invested in, and people are starting to invest in these people and these stories, and they want to see these players. So it's good that we've been able to move on from the golden era that's just passed, where these guys have been around for 15, 20 years. We're moving on to new people, and people are actually embracing the new characters that are there on the tour and not sticking with the old guard, who are either on their way out or have already retired.
Exactly. I like it. I'm looking forward to the matches. I have the day off, so I'm going to watch them. I'm not watching any basketball today. I'm kind of basketballed out. Finally, I have begun something I've been talking about with Craig for years, is a newsletter. I have become very disappointed in a nice way. I'm disappointed in the media. The tennis media is a joke. Disappointed in it. You hear this rat trap outside my house? This fucking guy has a car like that. He shouldn't be allowed to drive this car. This is in my parking. This is outside my house. What is this? I think it might be a delivery truck. But anyway, I have began what's called the Chip and Charge newsletter. I put it out a couple times a week now. It's free. And the reason I did is because I wanted to make sure that people got information that was credible and factual, and not some biased blogger pretending to be a journalist, because no one with any credibility wants to cover these tours. So I decided to start this, and it'll be out there. You can sign up for it. It'll always be free. You can sign up for that at philnasonsrights.com, or you can go on my Twitter feed, NasonsPhil, and you can find that link there. Sign up. And maybe we'll win some bets. We're 0-3 for the start of it, though. Shit. I got buried by the freaking tiebreaker demon. I can't get out of these tiebreakers, man. I just can't get past them. But that'll change, I hope.
It will, and I'm just going to echo what you said there. You sent me a link over to it, and I was impressed with the quality of the writing.
Because that's what I do different. For a living now, Craig. I write.
It's different to what you see elsewhere, and I still have a big appreciation for written content. I know a lot of people out there want to have all this sort of video content and Instagram and TikTok and all these sort of things, but a great written resource of information is still invaluable. It's something you can sit with and you can pour over. It's not somebody trying to sell something based on their charisma or their personality. It's actually somebody who's having to write something intelligent, factual, detailed. And I was actually really impressed with what you put together.
Well, I appreciate it. It took a while. And again, I thank my friend Josh for being the only... He didn't know better, but I promise you he does now. When he helped me like that, Craig, because like I said, Craig, he disappeared. He usually responds to me no matter where he is. He's like my little brother. I love this guy to death. But he didn't respond because he already knew what that was going to be. It took probably 15 tries to get it all sorted, and I finally just threw some money at it. But that's going to wrap it up for this edition of This Week in Tennis. Craig, one of the smartest tennis guys out there. Follow him. CD Sports Media. For Craig Doyle, I'm Phil Nasons. Thanks for listening to This Week in Tennis.
This Week in Tennis.